the men. And then, of course, it was a little better when the Americans came, because they did restore some of the privileges. I think it was during the occupation, that American occupation, that women gained the the equal voting
things,
suffrage, women's suffrage, long before the women in China or Korea or Japan. And they also established their own university, the Philippine Women's University, where the seed of this revival of the culture through dance and song was where it originated, because of the founder of this university, I forget her name right offhand. And it was really the first women's university in Asia, and Korea sometimes challenges that they had the women's university before in Asia. And we grant them, yeah, they did, but it was not formed by the Korean women themselves. It was formed by the missionaries, you know. But this, the one in the Philippines, was established, you know, by the women themselves. And we have the Filipino... when I was given the Women Warrior Award by the Asian Pacific Women's Network several years back, along with other Asian women who got this. I don't know if you've heard of that, the legend of the... It's based on a Japanese legend about this woman warrior that did her thing, you know, for the people. But we also had our women warriors, and they fought side by side, you know, with their men. And it's recorded in the legends and the epics and the folklore of the islands. So, and of course today, we also had the first woman president in Asia, Cory Aquino. And so women have done quite well as far as being Filipinos. There's a lot of literature, lots of opportunities for research if people want to go into that over there.
I wanted to ask what your experience of World War II was.
Oh, World War II, okay. I remember World War II, of course, because Bill and I were married that year when it started. We were married in August of that year, and 1941, and then of course the war with Japan started in December 7th, and of course the war in Europe, you know, was there. That's right, isn't it? The war in Europe had already was almost in its final stages. Didn't really end until 43. I mean, both in Europe and Asia. Well, I that was the year that I taught school, and so war was on, and my first remembrances about the war was teaching the kids what to do in case there was a bombing, you know. We'd have these bombing drills, and they'd all have to hide under the desk, you know, and I still remember that. But it wasn't until 43 when I really, when the war really impacted us as a family. Bill didn't go to war because he had a disability, but he did serve as a industrial arts teacher in the district, teaching welding and what do you call that with the airplanes? I forget. It wasn't welding. Riveting? Yeah. And so then I was pregnant with my first our first child, Billy. And so I had to leave teaching because at that time, if you were pregnant, you had to take a leave, you know, 3 months before and 3 months after. And but by that time, I was a pretty gregarious person and well and everything, and enjoyed my teaching and whatever. And I didn't like staying home, you know. And all these, and all of these things were happening all around me, you know. Men were leaving, women were wondering what to do, and women were going into airplane, becoming Rosie the Riveter kind of thing. And I told Bill, I said, Bill, I wish there was something that I can do, you know. And so I had a friend of mine who was staying with me at the time. She grew up with me in the Philippines, Lily Barkas. She's still around, but she lives up in Idaho. And and then Bill, besides his teaching, was also working a midnight shift at Bethlehem Steel, you know, on the harbor. And, well, he got this, while doing that, he got this job to, later on in 43, to do the test lab, to test welders that were needed to build the ships, because the U.S. was caught way behind in their shipping and airplane, and they needed welders like mad, and most of the men were gone, you know, to work. And so the call went out to train the women to do riveting and welding, and Bill was teaching this. He was also assigned to Banning High School because he was in industrial arts. And so he would come home and he'd tell me the stories of these women coming, you know, and learning how to weld, and they were having a good time and so forth and so on. He says, by the way, would you like to learn to weld? And I said, to weld? And he says, yeah, as long as I'm teaching there, why don't you come with me and Lily can watch, you know, Billy. And and so, well, okay, let's see what happens, you know. And when I started learning welding, boy, all the black women and the Hispanic women. And I remember one old Filipino man was there also teaching. And when we would have a rest period for dinner, for lunch or merienda or whatever, he says, time to eat, you know, just, and we'd all have fun, you know, like this. And so I really enjoyed that welding. To me, it was kind of like an art, because you had to get these pieces of steel, and you had to learn how to weld those two pieces together. And then later on, you had to know how to weld them upright. That was called vertical welding. And then you had to learn how to do it above, you know, this way. But you had to wear these hoods, you know, with the glass. Boy, did my eyes get burned, you know, the first few times. Really painful. Sometimes it was worse than a childbirth, you know, when you get your eyes, because you're not quite used to it, you know, and sometimes you know that spark, the light would leak through the hood. Well, anyway, you get used to controlling all of that. But what I enjoyed in terms of the art was you had to control that rod, you know, in terms of when to increase the heat, when to reduce it, you know, kind of like this. And then the beads, you call those beads, where the melted steel that you would form to form the bonding of those pieces of steel, made beautiful designs, you know. And I still remember that, and I thought it was, you know, really a great art. But anyhow...
Was this for the shipyards?
For Cal Ship is where I eventually went to work. But we learned to weld under the L.A. City Schools at Manning High School, where Bill was an industrial teacher. And then when he thought that you were ready to go for your test to see if you could pass the welding test and then, you know, be hired by Cal Ship, you know. So I took my test, and I was able to pass. You had to pass the three positions. And so I was able to pass, and so that's how I got to weld. And in the meantime, I'd gotten acquainted with the others, the blacks and the Hispanics. And so I went to work with many of them in the shipyard, and I was assigned to weld the sides of the ships. They were called the bulkheads of the ships, these Liberty ships, later called the Victory ships. And I remember telling you I saw this article in the paper where one of these ships was now being used as a tourist ship between San Pedro and Catalina. Well, anyway, and these ships were used for the landing ships, and I was so interested because some of them, you know, were used to land the troops or the Marines in the Philippines as well as the other islands. And anyway...
Were there mostly women?
Oh, yeah.
Welding?
Oh, yeah. They're mostly all women. And that, you know... We used to work on what they call the skids, which were floors, really, that were held upright, you know. And they'd place these slabs of steel, and as soon as another ship was ready to get these bulkheads, then we were busy. But sometimes in between, we didn't have any work to do. And there was always a man that was always the leader. The head man. They always had a man. He didn't want to lose his team when he got used to them, you know. So if any other lead man... Maybe there would be some who would be welding the interior of the ships or something like that. If they thought that you weren't busy, they could take you and go and work for him, you know. So when they weren't busy, they'd be walking through the shipyard, and if they see somebody not working, they can get him. So our lead man would always shove us under the shed so they couldn't see us, you know. If they came by and saw that we were waiting for some sheets of steel to come, because he didn't want to lose us, because he was experienced and we were experienced with him and knew exactly what to do. So while we were under there, we women would be talking with each other, and there were all kinds of women. There was even one flapper kind of young thing, you know, that she'd make us all laugh, you know, with all of her adventures, you know. Because I worked on the swing shift. Bill worked on the graveyard shift, and Lily, my friend, worked in the day shift. So we'd always have somebody to take care of a little Billy.
Wow.
and so we'd be talking, you know. And so one of the things, so we'd get serious too, and the thing that was serious was the women didn't have places to babysit their kids, you know. And so what should we do? Well, of course, I was kind of interested in that because of my work in school, you know, where I had learned so many times that kids were not in school because they were taking care of it. So we talked about that. And so what we decided that we had friends in the other shifts too. And so we decided we'd talk. I told them about my experience having, you know, although that was within my family, but maybe you have friends that might be working different shifts, and maybe you could trade off, you know. And so that really worked. And I always attribute that to the first time for babysitting, for child care, because we didn't have that before, but there that seed was planted there. And it's interesting because many years after the war, you know, we started the Head Start program, exactly that same kind of a concept, you know. And then also, I know that was the beginning of women empowerment, because this is the first time that women of color really had a chance to earn a good living, you know, because the pay was very good. And enjoy themselves, and they learned this skill the first time they were out of their homes, you know.
How did you feel? How did it make you feel?
Made me feel? Uh-huh. Oh, I enjoyed it. I really did. Because, you know, it seems like that's the kind of thing that I kind of like to do. I think I've kind of followed that all along, even with the library today. It's not so much that the library has done something, but the people who have used the library have gotten some kind of a seed planted in them so that they could, or some insight or some learning, and they've gone out and they've done things. You know, not totally because what they learned in the library, but associating with their other experiences. They talk about SEPA, you know, doing a great thing with the young people. Okay, they're doing these projects, but as far as the library is concerned, it's the same thing that was happening in under the sheds there during the war. You know, we were planting seeds, and people could go out and, you know, and develop whatever they got out of it. So I stayed in that welding for a while. I didn't go back to teach after my 3 months was over. Because I really enjoyed it. And it was really fun because Cal's ship was out in the water, you know. And I still remember the first day I went to work, all my leather clothing was all new, my things, my face, my helmet. I still have the helmet at home. When I have the library, I'm going to set it up there. And so that's what happened, you know, during the war. I think, you know, this has been kind of a funny thing, for lack of a better word. Later on, people wanted to do research about the women who worked during the war. But the emphasis is on women of color, people who were poor, and look what it did to them, you know. And I'd read about that, and I said, gee, I'd like to, you know, tell them. I'm not poor. I wasn't poor. It's just something that I enjoyed doing, you know, and I did things, you know. But they would never accept that, you know, as if, oh, well, you did that kind of for an adventure, you know, kind of. I mean, that was the attitude that was fed back to me.
Did you find there were other women having a similar experience?
Not very many. Not very many. And that's why people are surprised when I tell them, you know, that I did this. You know, they didn't expect me to do that. Even my family, you know. But Bill was always very accepting, you know. And I guess it goes back, you know, my own upbringing. You don't do things manual. You don't do things, you know, with your hand. But I enjoy doing it.
I have so many more questions for
it's you. It's 3:15, and okay. I have to be at the village at 4.
Oh, okay. Can I ask you one last question then about the library? about Parral and how that came to be.
Well, yeah, okay. I've been a collector all my life, and it seemed like I could never throw anything away that had any relationship to what I was doing that I enjoyed. It seemed as if I didn't want to forget, so I was always keeping things. And Bill was the same way. We had different interests, but you know, he was into keeping records of real estate, of travel, and things like that. So this kept piling up. I even brought stuff from the Philippines. Some of my dad's stuff, too, because he was a collector, too. Gosh. Well, anyway, it was his scrapbook, some of his experience in teaching in the Philippines, so that when I was in high school getting ready to graduate, I said, I have to make my own scrapbook. So I did a scrapbook, and I kept things, pictures, took pictures. Well, it seemed that just grew and grew and grew. And finally, after several years after retirement, Bill and said, what are we going to do with all this stuff here in the house, you know? And are we going to throw it away? Or, oh, no, I can't throw this stuff. That's my life. I said, and so at that time, I already knew Roy. I don't know if I told you about my meeting with Roy.
You did.
And I was sharing this with him. And he says, well, Helen, you know what? He says, do you know of any place, you know, a storage or whatever? And he says, well, you know, our church has a place in the basement of the church. And it's nothing but a storeroom where we just dump stuff, you know, into it. But you know, I have an idea. Why don't you go look at it and see, you know, what you think about it? So I went over there, and like that article said, it was a sliver of a room. That Jake, he was really, I enjoyed his interview. Well, anyway, it looked all right to me, so I brought Bill over. He looked at it, and he said, oh, I think so. So was very good, and he not only was interested in his mother was a teacher, by the way. He was not only very intellectual, he was also very good with his hands, and he was very earthy and interested in many things. And so he and the four boys all came down, and we cleared it out, you know, cleaned it up and painted it, and built the shelves and began to fill it up. it really wasn't a library of the church. It was that they donated the room. They didn't ask us for any compensation. Well, in the first place, they couldn't, you know, because that's part of the tax thing, I guess, about the church, that they can't charge things, but you know, donations are. So that's how we've kept it up.
What year was this, Helen?
I think it was in 1985. And so when it was done and ready to be opened, I was then good friends with Jackie Goldberg, and she had invited me to talk to her class at Cal State Long Beach, because she was teaching a class on library, and I told her about the Filipino collections and things, and I told her about this library, and she was very much interested and supportive, so we invited her to be the keynote speaker when we opened, and she cut the red ribbon, you know, off that door, you know, and so ever since then, you know, why we've just gone on. And then the leadership of the community, and they were largely professors in the Asian Studies Center as they began to learned about the library and things, why don't we form a foundation, you know, and let's get incorporated. And so we worked hard on that, and that's how we got this Pomona Foundation incorporated. It's a 501c nonprofit corporation. So that's relatively new, supports the library, that that's the main goal. So we're slow. Well, they're very busy people that are on the board, so it's really hard to give 100% attention, you know, to the library, but we're moving little by little.
And what does PARAL stand for?
Well, PARAL is the acronym for Filipino American Reading Room and Library. Pomona is a Filipino Tagalog word for heritage, means heritage. When I go to the bank, they say, "Oh, Panama? You mean Panama?" No, that's even the Filipino clerks. I know the Filipino clerks. I can tell, you know. Sometimes I miss, but usually I can tell, you know. And I said, "No, hindi Pomona, bakit?" You know.
What does that mean?
Oh, it means Pomona, bakit? Why? Why don't you know? You know. And they look at me and they say, "Are you Filipino?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I'm Filipino." "Really?" "Yeah, my mom's Filipino," I say. So anyhow, I have fun doing that. And so that was the start, yeah.
And what are your goals right now, your present
goals? Oh, the library?
And also what you're working on.
Well, hopefully we will. Well, first of all, we're working on a proposal so that we can get funding, so that we can have larger space. And our ultimate goal is to, it's not just the books and things, we also have arty crafts and things. I even have a bungalow in the back of the church that's already full of stuff, you know. So ultimately we hope to have a library and museum. I don't know how long that will be, but hopefully we will have one of these days. And it's largely to promote the Philippine-American culture. We like to emphasize that because we feel there's so much history and contribution of the Filipinos that they have made in America that people don't know about. Even our own people don't know about it, you know. For example, the galleon trade between Manila and Acapulco in the 1500s, you know, there was that cross-cultural kind of thing. A lot of our clothing and our food, our Spanish language and culture, some of it, you know, is part of the Philippine culture. And the Filipinos who landed here from the galleons. And there's so much there and so much to be researched, really, you know. So ultimately we hope that there will be, you know, more information to show, you know, part of the diversity of this country. I was reading in the paper the other day about these new consulates that are coming to make their consulate home here in Los Angeles, because they were talking about the latest one, which is Hungary, and this is Los Angeles and West LA, where they felt that they wanted to establish their consulate. Why? Because of the great diversity of the people in Los Angeles and the potential for peace here. And then they mentioned the riots, you know, last year. So why, you know? So that in itself is something that's really very challenging. So I think that's, again, is one of the goals, that the better we know each other, the better we know how to live with each other, and what better place to learn that right here, you know, in Los Angeles? And let's have the Filipino be a part of it. So that was it.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Helen?
Well, what I like to add is that I keep these scrapbooks. I cut out these articles. In fact, of course, there's so little written about the Philippines, let alone try to find an article coming to the LA Times, you know, about the Philippines. But there's so many articles that you really, from these other articles, you can depict, you know, kind of as, hey, you know, that really has a relationship with what the issues are about the Filipinos. There is a relationship about that. The Hispanics, you know, and the issues that they're involved with the blacks, with the other Asians, with the other people of color. There are struggles that are going on. Of course, then they're described in these articles. And I said, now that is, there is a relationship between what's being expressed here as what's true also the Filipino. So part of my collection is not only Filipino, but a selective review of those kinds of articles that show a cross-cultural emphasis. And, you know, I divide them into about 6 or 7 kind of categories, and I collect them. I've been collecting them since 1985, but they're not all cohesive yet because they're scattered around. I hope someday, maybe in a couple of years, to stop and then collect maybe a 10-year period to show this concept that I'm talking about. And so I have this categories in terms of perspectives, issues, values, identity, that's one. The other one is women, men, family, is another one. Arts and crafts, including folklore and paintings, writings. What's another one? Demographics. That's another important one. And health, the health issues. There's lots of cross-cultural emphasis there. There's about 8 of them, but those are the main ones that I can think right offhand. So that kind of keeps me busy, and I'm really comforted by the fact that you don't only want to keep your physical self in practice, but you got to keep your brain in practice if you're going to survive. So those are my excuses. Okay, well, Amy, if you think of anything that you might think of later, why, give me a call.
Okay.
I like talking to you.
Thank you very much, Helen.
Okay.